Man, tremendous singing this morning. Take your Bible again with me, if you will, and make sure you have it open to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7, the complete text for the message was read a moment ago in the scripture reading, but I would like to point out verse number 17. Matthew chapter 7, verse 17. Jesus said, "Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit. But a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit." And then verse number 20, Jesus said, "Wherefore by their fruits ye shall know them." By their fruits ye shall know them. How will you as a Christian be able to determine good from evil, right from wrong, black from white? How will you be able to determine what philosophies are good and which are wrong, what governmental systems are positive and which are negative, and what religious systems and beliefs have value and which ones do not? Jesus makes it very plain that the method of determination is to examine the fruit that has been produced, whether it be a philosophy, a religious belief system, even a political system. The way to judge its goodness, its morality, and its decency is by the fruit that that system has produced. It is my proposition to you this morning that Islam is at its very core a corrupt system of belief that has produced a fruit of violence, bloodshed, and mayhem since the earliest days of the revelations given to the Prophet Muhammad, I believe, by Satan, and continues in this day to manifest itself in a violence that threatens the security of the United States of America. In the news recently, we have heard that it is perhaps true that Al-Qaeda is as strong today as it was prior to the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Michael Chertoff has made the statement that he has a gut feeling that something big is going to come to America or to our interests overseas. We have the continuing idea given by the media, and sometimes I think downplayed and even masked by the media, but nonetheless present, that we as American citizens are still under threat. Based upon the religion of Islam, its teaching, and its ultimate mission, I can say assuredly that every American citizen stands under threat by a system that is forsworn to your personal and individual destruction. Islam is not merely a benign religious belief system of quiet monks who say mantras in a corner in front of a candle somewhere. Islam is a system of militancy, of promoting its belief not by winning the heart, but by forcing conversion at the edge of the sword. And it is my proposition this morning that the very basic and fundamental tenets of that religion, the original writings of the Prophet himself, teach and indicate that those who are involved in the so-called radical Islam are really the truest and most sincere followers of the false prophet Muhammad. Make no mistake about it today, American, those who commit mayhem worldwide and would commit bloodshed and savagery in our land, those who quote freely the Quran to justify their bloodshed, are those who most mirror the prophet Muhammad in his spread of his own religion. And they are they who most accurately represent what Islam is all about when you go back to the original and founding documents. Now remember what Jesus said, "A good tree does not bring forth corrupt fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit." By the fruit, by an examination of what is at the heart of the matter, by the fruit, we can understand and know the nature of this religion. Now, let me give you some preliminary considerations, and then I will get into the specifics of the message. Preliminary consideration number one, all philosophies and religions must be assessed according to the founding documents and by the lifestyle example set by their founders. It is only reasonable. If, for example, I want to understand Christianity, the best place for me to go is the pages of the New Testament, because the New Testament represents the founding doctrines of Christianity. How did the early disciples view Christ? How did the early Christians view Christianity? What does the New Testament, the founding and authoritative document, what does it have to say? Now, indeed, there have been groups that have strayed from the founding document, but interpretation and even reformation does not serve for me to understand what is the original intent. The New Testament gives for us the original intent of Jesus Christ as to His will for His church and for Christianity. Likewise, the volume known as the Quran reveals to us the original intent of the founder of Islam, Muhammad. It gives to us his vision. It gives to us his marching orders for all of his followers. Therefore, if I'm to understand that religion, I do not seek an American apologist who, according to the Quran itself, can lie to me concerning the tenets of his faith. But I go rather back further than that. Not to someone who's defending Islam or trying to paint a pretty picture or put a happy face on an otherwise ugly reality. I go back to the pages of the Quran and I find out, what did Muhammad himself say? Number two, the founding documents and lifestyle examples of the founders of any philosophy or religion, if they prove to be morally deficient, violence-promoting, or corruptive to civilized society, then that religion or philosophy must be rejected as fundamentally flawed. Now, someone will say, but Pastor, there is a moderate strain of Islam that does not interpret the violent passages of the Quran to mean violence. Listen very carefully. Reformation and moderate interpretation notwithstanding, as long as the words of the Quran literally taken invoke violence, bloodshed, and mayhem in this world, then that religion is fatally flawed from its inception, and it promises to be a threat to everyone who does not subscribe to its teaching. In other words, the original documents are fatally flawed. Even if some followers move far away from the actions and attitudes of Muhammad, or at least profess to, the very fact that they hold to such a document that promotes bloodshed and barbarism and has always been a bloodbath from its inception on throughout history, that very fact tells me that there is something flawed in the character of one who would hold so tenaciously to such a teaching. There are two primary sources that comprise the founding documents of Islam, the Quran and the Hadith. The Quran is supposed to be the revelations that were given by Allah to Muhammad, and this spanned a lengthy time period of his life. These revelations were not originally written down, but rather they were memorized and recited, and later people wrote them down and they were inscripturated to become, as it were, the Islamic Bible. The Hadith is a multi-volume series of books that record the life of the Prophet. The Hadith is considered authoritative, just as is the Quran. In the Quran, we have the teachings of the Prophet. In this multiple-volume set of the Hadith, we have the actions of the Prophet. We are told, for example, how the Prophet dressed in the morning, and his followers try to mimic his dress. We are told in the Hadith how the Prophet wound his turban, and his followers likewise seek to wind their turbans the same way he did. It is taught in Islam that mimicking the actions and attitudes of the Prophet is the surest way to please Allah, because Muhammad is to them the most pristine example of humanity that has ever lived. And so I go back to the sources. The sources. The Quran that is read by billions of people worldwide. The sources. The Hadith that is practiced by billions of people worldwide who follow this teaching. And I find, without having to dig very deeply, I find right on the surface a religion whose influence has produced such violence and bloodshed as to be incomparable to any other philosophy, religious or secular, that the world has ever known. The title of the message this morning, Islam Wants You Dead or Alive. Does Islam really want you dead? Do the people at the Islamic Society of North America, headquartered in Plainfield, Indiana, do they really read a book on a daily basis that says you should be put to death? Do they read a book on a daily basis that says your throat should be slit? Do they really hold, and I'm talking about our neighbors, do our neighbors really hold to the position that you as an American Christian are not worthy of life? If you were to interview the leadership in Plainfield, they would deny holding to such a position. But they would never deny tenaciously holding on to their Quran, their holy book, that teaches exactly that. I need to prove this today, because there are a lot of people that wander around saying Islam is a peaceful religion. On the eve of Ramadan, when Clinton was president, Clinton made a little Ramadan speech, and in that speech, he said, "We welcome Islam for all of the advances it has provided to society, because it is a peaceful and morality-producing religion." Is it really? Well, someone said, "Pastor, there are some peaceful verses in the Quran." I want you to listen very carefully. The Quran roughly can be divided into two sections. The early sections, written early in the life of Muhammad when he claimed to be a prophet, and the latter sections. In the early sections, which typically reflect his attitude while he still lived in Mecca, there was a sense in which the prophet was seeking to proselytize both Christians and Jews into his religion. He had founded a monotheistic belief system by removing from a place called the Kaaba all of the heathen gods, many hundreds of them that were worshipped in this pagan temple. Of the hundreds of gods that were worshipped in this pagan temple at Mecca, he chose one god, Allah, who was the moon god, to become his primary god, and he expelled the Parthenon of gods from the Kaaba ultimately, and exalted this one god, Allah, the moon god, and established a monotheistic belief. It was his thought that he could attract other monotheists, such as Christians and Jews, into his leadership, and so he appealed to them by the nature of preaching. The verses in the Quran that you will sometimes read that seem to promote peace toward Christians and Jews are verses that were written very early in the life of the prophet. The caveat is this. Surah chapter 2, verse 106, is the verse in the Quran that gives us the doctrine of abrogation. If you do not understand this, you will be deceived by Islamic scholarship. Abrogation is the teaching that the earlier verses of the Quran were authoritative only for the earlier portion of the prophet's life. Abrogation teaches that it is the later revelations that apply to today. And so if the prophet early in his ministry had appealed to Jews and Christians to join with him in his belief system and had done so in a peaceful manner, that was for the early part of the prophet's ministry. Later on, after the verse of abrogation, the prophet contradicted every peaceful passage in the Quran. Now, did you hear me? That was very key. To the sincere Islamic, to the sincere Muslim, there are no peaceful passages in the Quran that apply today. That was for the early portion of the prophet's life. The verse of abrogation now teaches that anyone who is Islamic must abide by the violence verses. And in fact, it is the verses that promote the killing, the bloodshed, the violence, and the mayhem that are authoritative for today. And anything purporting to peace has been simply set aside. Understanding then the principle of abrogation when I read the Quran. And by the way, that is an Islamic theological concept that they teach. Understanding the principle of abrogation when I read the Quran, it is especially important for me to note the later writings of the prophet. What are some of his later writings? Here is what Muhammad said. In Surah chapter 4, verse 89, quote, "Those who reject Islam must be killed. If they turn back from Islam, take hold of them and kill them wherever you find them." That is authoritative for today. By the way, it was played out in the life of the Prophet Muhammad, actually at the point of his death. When Muhammad died, he had subjugated much of the Arabian Peninsula to his new religion, but there were many who chafed under that subjugation. After his death, by the way, potentially as a result of poisoning due to his taking the wife of another man, which is something that the Prophet did frequently with permission of Allah. After his death, there was great unrest among the tribal peoples of the Arabian Peninsula, and many of them desired to throw off this yoke, this belief system of Islam. The man who followed in authority after Muhammad was a man named Abu Bakr, who happened to be Muhammad's father-in-law. He ordered, after the death of Muhammad and the subsequent upheaval and the uprisings against Islam, he ordered that, according to the verse I've just read, everyone who had rejected their former Islamic belief would be put to death. It is an absolute historic fact that within 2 years of the death of Muhammad, 70,000 former Islamics who had forsaken their newly found faith, 70,000 of them were, by the authority of the verse I just read, put to death by the edge of the sword. 70,000. A corrupt tree bringeth forth corrupt fruit. What else did Muhammad say in Surah 47, verse 4? Quote, "So when you meet those who disbelieve, smite their necks, till when you have killed and wounded many of them, they bind a bond upon them firmly and take them captive." What is the command? Behead your enemies until you subjugate enough of them that you can take captives when you're in power. Notice, if you will, the difference between that and the New Testament. Jesus said, love your enemies. See, a good tree bringeth forth good fruit. A corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. Some years ago, Syed Mohammed Said, who used to be the Secretary General of the Islamic Society of North America in Plainfield, wrote in the newspaper, I believe it was the Indianapolis Star, he wrote that the custom of beheading, remember when all of the beheadings were going on the internet and then broadcast on television, he said the custom of beheading has no place in the history of Islam. He said that in the newspaper. Syed Mohammed Said is a liar. By the way, he is no longer in Plainfield. Oh, Pastor, that's a good thing. He's no longer near us. It's a bad thing. He is in Washington, D.C., and he is one of the highest level of lobbyists for the Muslim cause in the United States of America, having access to some of the highest echelons of elected power and officials in our land. It's dangerous. Very dangerous. Another verse, Surah 9, 123. The Prophet said, "O you who believe, fight those of the disbelievers who are close to you, and let them find harshness in you, and know that Allah is with those who are pious." These verses that I'm quoting in English today are those that are quoted in Arabic as the Islamic extremist terrorists fly planes into buildings or blow themselves up. Surah 8:67, "It is not for a prophet that he should have prisoners of war until he have made a great slaughter in the land." So much for the Geneva Convention. We understand from this that all that the Prophet said was promotive of violence. The authoritative verses, the ones authoritative for today. Continuing, another quotation, "Let not the unbelievers think that they can get the better of the godly or of the Muslims. They will never frustrate them. Against them make ready your strength to the utmost of your power, including steeds to war, to strike terror into the hearts of the enemies." Islam as a religion based upon the words of its founder has as its mission the striking of terror into the hearts of its enemies. When a man commits terrorism in the name of Allah or Islam, he is obeying the exact teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, and he expects to receive a reward from his false god, Allah. Now, this is the teaching of the Quran. One of our young people in a secular college was recently rebuked by a professor because in a paper she wrote, she mentioned that Islam is a violent religion. And the professor corrected her and said, no, you can't say that. You simply cannot say that Islam is a violent religion. This is a professor on the undergraduate level. Ladies and gentlemen, an individual doubtless who has never read the Quran, an individual doubtless who has no idea of Arabian history or the history that has gone into that portion of the world and how it has been affected since Muhammad and beyond. You see, the marching orders of the religion of Islam, the current marching orders of the Islamic terrorists, are these words found in Surah 8, verse 39. Quote, "Fight them until there is no more fitna or disbelief in polytheism, and the religion will be for Allah alone. Fight them." Who's the them? All non-Muslims. "Fight them until the religion shall be for Allah alone." Those are the marching orders for every sincere and real Muslim. They are the words of the Prophet, and there is not one Islamic scholar who would deny these words. They are written late, and that means they are authoritative for today. But do we find this concept, Pastor, of a universal Islamic state? Are they really trying to take over the world? Well, I'm glad you asked. Yesterday in the paper, some of you probably read this article, Bin Laden video invites U.S. to embrace Islam. Osama bin Laden appeared for the first time in 3 years in a video Friday released ahead of the 6th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, telling Americans that they should convert to Islam if they want the war in Iraq to end. All we have to do is convert, and then there'll be peace. Going on, the story goes on to say, he addresses Americans, lecturing them on the failures of their leaders to stop the war in Iraq, despite the growing public opposition in the U.S. That's Obama's position. I sure wouldn't vote for a politician that parrots Osama bin Laden. I wouldn't do it. Well, Pastor, shouldn't we get out of Iraq? Not if bin Laden thinks we should. Think about that. Here is a quotation. Bin Laden said there are two solutions to stopping the war in Iraq. One is from our side, Osama says. It is to escalate the fighting and killing against you. This is our duty, and our brothers are carrying it out. Mr. Bin Laden has a keen grasp of Islamic theology, because according to the words of the Prophet, it is his duty, and they are carrying it out. And he says, we can answer you, we're not going to give up, but we're going to escalate the battle. The second solution offered by Osama is from your side. He says, I invite you to embrace Islam. Oh, well, what happens if we embrace Islam? Quote, it will achieve your desire to stop the war as a consequence, because as soon as the warmongering owners of the major corporations realize that you have lost confidence in your democratic system, Islam and democracy are not compatible. Osama bin Laden understands this. We need to understand it as well. He says, as soon as you have lost confidence in your democratic system and have begun to look for an alternative, and this alternative is Islam. Not for me. Not for you. But it is their goal. Their original documents give them the marching orders. Those that blow themselves up in Allah's cause are the most sincere, real, and pristine followers of the false prophet Muhammad. There's also, though, evidence not only from his writing, but from his life example. Well, what was Muhammad's life like? Well, Muhammad's life, as the Quran, can really be divided into two epochs of time. The first being the early epoch, that is when he began his religion in Mecca, and the later part when he had to flee to Medina to find protection and ultimately adopted the political and the quasi-military functions of his Islamic followers. In the early time periods, Muhammad, in his preaching in Mecca, invited people to come to Islam by preaching, and he did preach to the irritation of many in that city. Later in Medina, he converted people by the edge of the sword, convert or be killed. Early on in Mecca, he lived sort of like a priest and practiced prayer and fasting and worship. But later in Medina, he lived like a military commander and personally led 27 bloody attacks against caravans, killing, looting, pillaging, and raping. Peaceful religion. Glaringly different from the founder of Christianity, whose message to a lost and dying world was one of love. Jesus said, "Love your enemies." In the early years in Mecca, Muhammad had only one wife. Her name was Khadija. He was married to her for 12 years. After she died, he married in succession at least 12 more women within a 10-year span of time. One of his wives was 6 years old when he married her. The marriage to this 6-year-old was physically consummated when she was 9. That, by any standard of any society, anywhere, is pedophilia. Call it what you want. If he were here in the United States today, he would be either behind bars or on a watch list. This is the fruit of the prophet, but by their fruit ye shall know them. And a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. All Muslims agree, and no serious historian denies, that Muhammad personally engaged in battle, mass murder, and pillage. In Medina, he killed all the men of one Jewish tribe in the presence of their wives and children, and just hours later, he married one of the women whose husband had been slain before her eyes. This is filth. This is vile. This is barbarism. This is not only anti-Christian, it is anti any form of common decency anywhere in the world, and this is the lifestyle of the man who founded this demonic religion. He personally led, as I mentioned a moment ago, 27 murderous campaigns against infidels, and his truest followers carry out his mission today. Does Islam really want you dead? A literal reading of the words of the prophet would affirm without any question that you, as an infidel, an unbeliever, one who has not accepted the tenets of the Islamic faith, will either convert or die. What about evidence from our time? We're here today to commemorate the 9/11 attacks. The conclusion is obvious. But there have been multiple murderous and terror attacks for years, bombings, slayings, the USS Cole, London, Madrid, attempts in Germany, riots in France. All we need to do is open our eyes. Sometimes we can't see things because they aren't explained to us in terms that we understand. Some of you recall in 2002 that there was the deliberate crash of a small plane into a Tampa, Florida high-rise. What you did not hear in the popular media was that the man who crashed this plane had been a bin Laden sympathizer. They blamed the plane crash on the acne drug Accutane. Oh, he was taking that acne drug, and he freaked out. In 2003 in Houston, there was the murder and near beheading of an Israeli by a Saudi Arabian. And yet in that murder, no religious motivation could be discovered. In 1990, Egypt Air Flight 990, in which 217 people died, was crashed when the co-pilot wrenched the controls and dove the plane into the ocean as he praised Allah and quoted from the Quran. The religious side of some of this you do not hear. October 1st, 2005, Norman, Oklahoma, at the football game, Joel Henry Heinrichs III, American-born and bred, blew himself up with a suicide bomb outside of the gates of that football stadium in Norman, Oklahoma. What the media did not report about this quote-unquote deranged young man was that only months previous, he had converted to Islam at the urging of his roommate, who could not be found after the incident and had left the country. He converted to Islam and was a regular attender at a mosque that is located only a few blocks away from the stadium in Norman, Oklahoma. The morning after this occurred, I received a call on the telephone here at the office. It was a pastor from Texas. I did not know the man, but he said, "Pastor, I've read some of your things on the internet and heard some things." He said, "Did you know that the explosion in Norman was an Islamic terror attack?" I said, "No." I said, "What evidence do you have?" He said, "A man in my church who'd moved from Texas to Oklahoma worked with the ATF. He was one of the men who actually entered this young man's apartment when they did the investigation. He called his pastor later and he said the apartment was filled with jihadist literature, bomb-making literature, and the Quran." The fact of this young man's religious affiliation was not mentioned in the major news sources and was downplayed. In January of 2005, the Armanius family, who lived in New Jersey, they were Egyptian people, Arab people. Mr. Armanius was a Coptic Christian, which is a form of Christianity that is essentially Egyptian. He had been on the internet in a chat room, and he had been arguing back and forth with some Islamics, and he, of course, spoke the language, and they had the same background culturally. He had been arguing back and forth with them, and finally the argument became so heated about religious matters that those Islamics with whom he was arguing sent threatening notes and said, "If you continue your tirade against Islam, you and your family will pay." Days later, the four of them were found in their New Jersey home, with their throats slit. But there was no evidence that religious hatred had played any part in their mysterious deaths. Do not think this does not happen in the United States. Islam wants you dead, but I hasten to say this, Islam also wants you alive. They want you. Statistics are difficult to verify, but there are as many as 6 million Muslims living in the United States today. Between 1989 and 1998, the Islamic population of Europe grew by over 100%. In roughly the space of a decade, in the same time period, the Muslim population in the United States grew by 25%. If the European growth rate continues, Europe will have a population of 1.9 billion, I said billion, Muslims by 2025. One quarter of the population will be Muslim. Pastor, how are they accomplishing this? Listen carefully. By liberal immigration policies and by multiplication. They're having children at an alarming birth rate. One year recently in Belgium, the birth rate overall was 57% Muslim in the land of Belgium. The largest concentration of Muslims in America live in New York, Michigan, California, and Illinois. There are 400,000 Muslims living in Chicago alone. If you doubt me, try to take a taxi cab someday. Islam could become the second largest religion in America by 2015, surpassing Judaism. There are some that claim that Islam has already achieved this. It's difficult to count Muslim converts because Muslim mosques do not keep rolls of members. They don't have membership rolls, so it's difficult to count that. Several American converts to Islam, I'm talking about American young people born and reared in our nation, several American converts to Islam have been implicated in terror plots against the United States of America. Many of us probably don't remember the name Derek Sherif. We should, because last Christmas time, Derek plotted to blow up a shopping center in Rockford, Illinois. Again, he was described as an unstable and deranged young man, and what was not reported was that he was a convert, an American convert to Islam. The problem is we hear so much about it, little snippets on the news. Car bombing in Algeria, plot failed in France, attempted bombings foiled in London, many dead in supper clubs somewhere else in the world. We hear these so many times, we've become immune to it. And it all garbles together, and we don't understand that these things are taking place in the United States. Our president, under heavy pressure from his critics, opened a little crack in the secrecy a few months back, and he said it has been the success of Homeland Security in the United States to have foiled numerous plots against the citizens of this country. If the plots foiled were numerous, I wonder how close they were to Indianapolis. I wonder how close they were to Chicago. They are numerous. But Islam wants to recruit you. They're becoming very large and influential. It is interesting to note that in Latino countries, there is a significant rise in Latino converts to Islam, those who are leaving the Catholic Church and converting to the Islamic faith. Preacher, why is that dangerous? Consider the border problem in Mexico, if you wonder why that is dangerous. There has been an ongoing cultural influence in the United States for some years. Interestingly, in an article, April 2000, Christianity Today, this before the 9/11 attacks, Christianity Today talked about the influence of Muslim culture in America. They said that Detroit hospitals now routinely offer copies of the Quran to patients, that the Denver International Airport includes a chapel for Muslim prayers. We know that the U.S. Senate has been opened in prayer by a Muslim cleric, and now a senator has been sworn in on the Quran. Muslim chaplains are in the armed forces. The White House sends out greeting cards now to mark Islamic holidays. And Muslim lobbyists have access to the highest offices in our land. Oh, well, Pastor, now, Sayyid Mohammed Sayyid from the Islamic Society of North America, he's now at Washington, but surely Washington's got his number. I'm not so sure about that. In my research, I was able to come up with a document, very small print document. This is the testimony before the United States Senate Committee of the Judiciary, entitled Terrorism, Growing Wahhabi Influence in the United States, June the 26th, 2003. The man who testified was a man by the name of Mr. Stephen Schwartz. Mr. Stephen Schwartz, in his testimony before a Senate subcommittee in 2003, said this, that the Islamic Society in Plainfield, the Islamic Society of North America, represents Wahhabism or Wahhabi Muslim movement that is the most violent and bloody of all belief systems incorporated into Islam. A Senate subcommittee has heard this man's expert testimony, but it appears in some senses to have fallen on deaf ears. Today, California schools teach an Islamic-friendly curriculum that includes role-playing, encouraging elementary students to pretend that they are converts to Islam. Can you imagine the fervor that would arise if we had a public school curriculum that encouraged students to pretend that they were Christians? But yet you can do this in the name of multiculturalism so long as it's not Christianity and it is Islam. What is our threat? A great threat that we face today, frankly, is our indifference. Our indifference. Every American should have been alarmed somewhat by the news this week that German police had foiled a plot in Germany. Oh, but Pastor, that's in Germany. We don't have to worry. That plot was aimed at the destruction of the Ramstein Air Force Base. It is that base that is one of the chief supply bases for our ongoing war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm not surprised that they would target the American soldiers and citizens that work on that base because their marching orders from Muhammad is to kill all of them. I'm not surprised that they would attack that base because it is the supply depot from which our efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq are supplied. So that doesn't surprise me. Their attacking that base would be a tactical maneuver and it would support the insurgency in Iraq. What should surprise every person in this room, that of the three that have been captured as principal actors in this attempted terror plot, two of the three were German-born citizens and converts to the religion. The third was a Turkish man, doubtless their mentor. You say, Pastor, what does this mean to us? It means this. We are facing an age and an enemy that would take from us everything we love and cherish as American citizens. Pastor, that's a very sweeping statement. Well, let me quote Muzamil H. Siddiqui, by the way, president of the Islamic Society of North America. What did he have to say about their plans for your future? I quote, North America needs our contribution. It is up to us to make an imprint in founding a truly Islamic civilization on this continent. Is that what you want? Is that what you want for your children and for your grandchildren? A truly Islamic civilization to be founded on this continent? I don't think so. But that is the ultimate goal. Pastor, well, we're against it. At the same time, we play into it. As Americans, we do so by our ignorance and by our indifference. I'm going to close with these thoughts. One of the greatest dangers to our civilization and to our land, to our country's future, is not bombs and tanks and guns from a foreign nation. One of the greatest threats we have is not even these people who live among us, who by their religious views are sworn to do us harm. That is not even one of the greatest threats we face. One of the greatest threats we face is the indifference of the American people who are so busy pursuing the American dream, rushing the kids to soccer practice, building and buying bigger and better and more, that a message like this is troubling, frustrating, and is pushed to the background because, frankly, it makes us all very uncomfortable. The solution to our security rests in our understanding the nature of this religion, knowing its bent for violence, and then pushing it to the very fringe of our society. Oh, Pastor, this is a free land. People can worship as they will. Oh, yes, I agree. But there are other groups that we effectively push to the fringe of our society, and we don't publicize them and promote them. The Ku Klux Klan, they're welcome to their beliefs, but we push them to the fringe of our society. When you understand that the very nature and founding of this religion is violence and corruption, you as an American citizen will say, rather than give them kudos, rather than legitimatize them by promoting their clerics in public places, we should eschew them to the very fringe of existence, recognizing them and relegating them to the long list of hate organizations that curse and blight our land. And for you as a Christian, the answer is this: militant evangelism of the lost. A vacuum was created in the United Kingdom as church membership plummeted and as the influence of Christianity from the Victorian era decreased to where it's almost non-existent. That vacuum is being filled in the United Kingdom by people who subscribe to witchcraft, by pagan religions, and it is also very effectively and very powerfully being filled by preachers of the Islamic faith who are winning hundreds and thousands of converts every year because of people who are empty-hearted. Now listen, folks, we have the saving gospel of Jesus Christ. We have the answer. We have that message which will meet the deepest need of their heart. And it is our responsibility to win them to Him, to show them His love through their hatred, to go beyond being intimidated and to aggressively tell them that there is freedom and deliverance from the bondage of their wicked religious system if they'll turn in saving faith to Jesus Christ. A good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit, and those who live among us must see the difference. Let's pray. Father, I pray you'll take our thoughts this morning. Help us, Lord, to understand that at its very core, this belief system is vicious and vile and has as its marching orders bloodshed and violence. Help us, Lord, to understand that it is a belief system that echoes the very desires of hell and Satan himself. Help us, Lord, to understand that we as believers have the truth, the only light, the only way that these can be changed in their heart by faith in Christ. I pray, Father, you will give us a holy boldness in our society to preach to all, whoever they may be, the unsearchable riches of Christ. And, Father, to educate and to stand in firm opposition against those movements that would threaten the existence of our nation and of the systems and the traditions that we love. I pray you'll bless this, your people. May this church be a lighthouse in this community. We pray it in Jesus' name. Let's stand together, please. Everyone standing together.